Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Elizabeth Hill, filling in for Sarah LaDuc. Each weekday morning, WAMC President, CEO, and political observer Alan Chartok and Roundtable host Joe Donahue are joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature your favorite panelists discussing some important news items from that week. On Wednesday, Alan and Joe were joined by Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin, Director, Actor, Educator, and Co-Founder, and Artistic Director of Wham Theater, Kristen Van Genhoven, and Investment Banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman.
Let us begin with complications in the documents case. We've been talking about this a little bit on and off for the past 2 or 3 weeks, ever since the Biden document issue became an issue. But there is an article in the New York Times today that I think is quite interesting about how Biden's handling of secret documents complicates the case against Donald Trump. Now, you'll remember, and I think on this program and many, many others in the mainstream media, if you will, a lot of people have said that this issue could be the biggest one, the most problematic one for the former president of the United States, Donald Trump. Well, in comes the issue and issues regarding classified documents and President Biden, our current president. The cases are markedly different in their particulars, but they are similar enough that as a practical matter, Democrats will have a hard time using the issue against Donald Trump, simply because you're talking about the headline is basically the same. You have found classified information that shouldn't have been taken. It was taken, and it shouldn't have been there. Again, I know, please don't write. We know the particulars are different, but FBI agents are rummaging through President Biden's private home. Republicans are on attack. Democrats are reluctant to defend him. Lawyers are being hired. Witnesses are being interviewed. The press secretary is being pelted with questions she cannot or will not answer. But amid the familiar soundtrack of scandal in Washington, the most significant cost to the president may be the opportunity cost. Even if nothing comes of the new special counsel investigation into the team's mishandling of classified documents, politically, it has effectively let former President Donald Trump off the hook for hoarding secret papers. The cases are markedly different in the particulars, as has been noted repeatedly. Mr. Biden has cooperated with the authorities, inviting them to search his home, while Mr. Trump defied efforts to recover documents even after being subpoenaed, prompting a judge to issue a search warrant. But they are similar enough that as a practical matter, Democrats can no longer use the issue against Mr. Trump politically, and investigators may have a harder time prosecuting him criminally. Alan Chartok, do you agree with that premise?
Well, look, you know, for those people who want to hold Trump responsible for many of the things that he's done, this is a little bit of a setback. Nevertheless, the premise is that what's good for the goose and the gander are sort of the same thing. And it's a tough one because how do you hold somebody responsible if you're letting others off the hook?
Bob?
Yeah, I mean, if I were Donald Trump, I would come out today saying, see, everybody's doing it. And I'm just being persecuted and throw more mud into the water. As someone who dealt with classified materials in a past life, if I had done this, I would be in jail. Okay, so for people who, you know, the normal people, the little people who deal with classified information, there seems to be a double standard here. This thing with Biden, I think he mishandled it. I think if he had been a little bit more humble and taken it more seriously, rather than saying there's nothing here, he would have. He could have weathered this better than he's doing. This whole event really kind of rubs the veneer of adulthood. You know, the idea of, you know, I'm going to go into the White House and be an adult rubs a little bit of it away. So I actually think that the situation with Pence and Biden really does help Trump. And I also think that Biden didn't handle the situation well. And I think Pence is right now probably handling it the best of all three.
We will talk about the Pence case in a moment. We have not spoken about that directly, and I would like to talk about some of the particulars of that case. Because as we pointed out, while they have similar headlines, they are all different in one way or t'other. Mark Whitman.
I agree with a lot of what Bob said. I think Biden lost a lot of the upper hand when the documents were found in his possession for two reasons. First of all, the whataboutism that will be used and is being used to obscure the differences, I think is politically important. I also think Biden has now actually done harm to himself because he wasn't fully honest. And when I say honest, let me talk about, for instance, if you honesty has many components to it. It's sort of like if you're selling your house, you're not only interested in the price, but the speed and certainty with which you close. And honesty has those attributes as well. It's not only truthfulness, but speed of delivery of that truth and the certainty around it. And Biden fell short, miserably short, on the speed and certainty points. And as Bob said, I think he's lost a lot of the credit that was due him for up until then being more of an adult than his predecessor and many others in government.
What do you think, Kristen?
Yeah, I think it's definitely a missed opportunity for Biden to be, you know, another example of his integrity and honesty if he had come out and used it as an opportunity to discuss how the examination of the process around classified documents clearly needs attention. You know, and that was a missed opportunity. He could have used it to address the system. I think the ship has sailed in terms of Trump and the classified documents. That, unfortunately, it's going to be too challenging. I mean, it's a very difficult position for Merrick Garland to be in. There's certainly, you know, we all know what the differences are, and you'll get lots of letters about it anyway. But it's still going to be quite challenging. But where the opportunity lies and where I think somebody can really go high in this is what Larry Pfeiffer was talking about on PBS last night. You know, he's somebody who is a recognized expert in these areas, ran the Obama Situation Room. And, you know, it's we all know how easy it is when you're in the situation, especially in America, where it's like, you know, you do the thing and you ask for forgiveness later, which, you know, I learned the hard way as a Canadian. That there are, you know, every congressperson, cabinet member, everybody who's ever been in the White House is searching every nook and cranny of their house right now. You know, it's very easy to take things away. There are so many different levels of classified materials, you know, and Larry gave a really succinct overview of how the process could be reexamined and reviewed. And I think a lot of those strategies should be taken up, and Biden could have been the hero around reforming the system around classified materials. So that's a missed opportunity.
That's a really good point. I think the system is in dire need of an overhaul. I think that too much is classified, both out of paranoia and sometimes laziness. Mm-hmm. This is something that should be a bipartisan activity to reform the system. If the Senate could stop kvitching about Ticketmaster and the House is kind of hopeless right now. But this is something that would benefit everybody. There's a lot of information that people need that they can't get access to because getting security clearances takes so long and is so onerous, is so expensive that it actually has a negative impact on the overall security of the country.
Bob, I asked this question yesterday, and I was sort of poo-pooed by the panel, but I'm interested in your thoughts on it. It seems to me, and this is just something I don't quite understand, but this is about the Friday investigation into Joe Biden's house in Wilmington, Delaware. And from my understanding, the Biden team worked with the DOJ to come up with a day and a time for them to come in and to search the premises. Why would they not have searched the house themselves to give themselves an opportunity to say, the minute they come to the door, do whatever you need to do, but by the way, this is what we found. doesn't that have better optics to it than a 9 to 13 hour search that goes on from room to room to room to room to room, where items that go back 15 years in some cases are found? I don't understand that aspect. I know this is what I thought about when I was a kid. Aunt Em used to buy us really ugly paintings for holidays. And then whenever Aunt Em would come visit, we would go find them and put them up on the wall. And it would take us a really long time to find Aunt Em's paintings. But if we knew Aunt Em was on the way, we would go and find them so we would be ready when she walked through the door.
Yeah. So let's compare the three cases, because I think the optics of the FBI going into Biden's home gives the perception that there's it is an equation between what they did in Mar-a-Lago versus what they did in Delaware.
Because you're using again the word raid.
Exactly. And you know, let me juxtapose that with what happened with Pence, where his attorneys went in, they found them, they returned the documents to the government, they let the government know, and it's being taken and as a completely sort of a different has a very different feel than the Biden and certainly a different feel than the Trump situation. I think the optics, I'm not sure people really thought through the optics of what an FBI search, and I'm sure in their initial mind they're thinking that, you know, we're going to be good people, we're going to let the DOJ know, we're going to bring in separate investigators in the FBI, we're doing everything that we can do to make this thing as clean as possible, and it looked like a raid. It smelled like a raid. It sounded like a raid. In which case, you know, the FBI doesn't come through normal people's homes unless they have a real reason to, and this is part of the optics that I think helps Trump and certainly hurts Biden. If you again look at the Pence situation and how that's being handled versus how the other two situations are being perceived. Optically, it was horrible. And, you know, Joe, there were enough people on the president's staff who have classification where they could have gone and searched for those documents. The other thing that honestly kind of chaps me is in the situation with Pence, I understand he didn't open the boxes. OK, anybody who's moved knows that you have boxes you don't open for a while. The thing with Biden that really chapped me, though, is that they were classified documents all the way back to when he was in the Senate. I mean, so this is a much longer, there's a much longer road for the Biden situation than the Pence road.
To my knowledge, those documents have not been dated as to what era they're from. But best case, they're from 2008, 2000, early 2009. But my God, they could have gone back to the 70s.
Exactly. And then there's going to have to be the forensics investigation to find out whether they were declassified. I mean, there's a lot of work that will have to go into these situations.
It was making me think about like what we've been hearing around, that the declassification is just, one of those things at the bottom of the list that people don't get to. We're also reading a lot about the levels of classification and that, some things are like travel details versus some things are like foreign security. So there's much that needs to be parsed out around, the which level of classification and how much is this, the risk management around those details, and that has to be part of the overarching review of everything. I also think that, there could have been a conversation around the optics of thinking, well, it has to be done in quote unquote the same way as it was done for Trump, because they knew otherwise that, the right was going to be like, well, he got different treatment, he didn't get the 13-hour search, et cetera, et cetera. So perhaps it was a calculated guess of like, no, we're not going to do this ourselves. We want to be seen as having the same treatment, that's imperative. Mm-hmm. So it's very difficult to know, all the backroom talk that was going on. But you can bet your bottom dollar over the next couple of weeks that we're going to be hearing about other people who were in the Senate from, Patrick Leahy, who knows, who have certain levels of quote unquote classified documents in their home. But how, you know, the risk management, we need to start reading about how much has those classified documents put us at risk as a country.
Before you go to Mark, Joe, just one, I think there is one really important, it's not really a correction, but the situation with Trump, though, is that the Department of Justice tried to get him to return documents. Okay. And I think that's this is a very, very important distinction. They only went in when they felt that there was no other step. And so in some respects, I think if we're going to say everything should have been equal, then Biden should have had the right to do his own do an internal first. So there is the situations are different.
Mark?
Back to Bob's narrow point about the Biden administration being wrongfully and overly deferential to the investigators. Bob, I think you're right on the optics of the search. And I think the problem of the Biden administration handling of their interplay with the investigators goes all the way back to their delaying their announcement of what Biden found. Last week, there was a story in the Washington Post that seemed to me as if it were planted by administrative officials trying to explain why it is Biden and the administration wasn't immediately forthcoming by saying, well, because we were working with Justice to clear all this up, we were going to let them take the lead. But I was really disappointed when I read that because, Bob, as you say, Biden's got to have a lot of people on his administration who are adults, who understand the legalities around this, and who could have simply called up Justice and said, look, it's time for us to come clean. And that date, by the way, would have been about a day after they found what they found.
Right.
And say, look, we're going to come clean and we're going to make an announcement. And at every point, and obviously they would have made a first announcement, then you would have had somebody with the proper clearance go check every place Biden has been since he might have acquired these documents, and you would have made a second announcement saying, here's what else we found. Instead of, they say accidentally obfuscating the truth here as they've done by being overly differential. I think this has been mishandled not only in the physical search, but also in terms of the announcement of what they found and when they found it.
Mark, I can't disagree with you. And again, I think this just helps Trump in his case, even though there are substantive differences. Now, for all of the players involved, one of the things that I think you can take heart in is what a lot of the pollsters are saying, and I've heard it on a couple of different channels, is that honestly, the public is not really paying attention to this. The people that are so morally outraged about Biden were morally outraged before and will be morally outraged afterwards, and the people who don't like Trump didn't like him before. And honestly, when we start to think about 2024, will this be a blip? Yeah, it'll be a blip, but it'd be nothing compared to what the economy or potentially, an expansion of the Russia-Ukrainian war or some of those other situations.
Nevertheless, if they keep themselves, if they let themselves be vulnerable intellectually, even criminally, any other way, it doesn't look good for them, right?
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, this is a self-inflicted wound. All right. It wasn't going to be good no matter what, but at the same time, it could have been handled a heck of a lot better. And maybe it just got caught in the change in chief of staff. I've sort of puzzled why this thing was handled so poorly. It's funny listening to some of the senators, including Mark Warner, who came out today saying, just so you understand, the only time I don't understand how these documents could get in, misplaced, because we can only look at them in a SCIF, which is a special room that you can look at classified materials. So you already starting to see, senators and others trying to distance themselves from the inevitable question of, well, what do you have in your files?
Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin, on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, January 25th. Please note, as you listen, any given topics, details, and or facts may have changed since our live broadcasts earlier in the week. And we'll be back with more after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, Alan and Joe were joined by Albany's Chief City Auditor, Dorcia Pleers, Peabody and Emmy Award-winning journalist, Linda Ellerby, Publisher Emeritus of the Daily Freeman, Ira Fussfeld, and Chairman of the Capital District Latinos, Dan Arizari.
The story about tanks. Now, we haven't talked a lot about this this issue, although it's been going on in the news for the past several days. So this is the Biden tank plan and sending tanks to Ukraine. The headline in the New York Times says how Biden reluctantly agreed to send tanks to Ukraine. The decision unlocked a flow of heavy arms from Europe and inched the United States and its NATO allies closer to direct conflict with Russia. President Biden's announcement Wednesday that he would send M1 Abrams tanks to Ukraine came after weeks of tense back-channel negotiations with the Chancellor of Germany and other European nations, who insisted that the only way to unlock a flow of heavy European arms was for the U.S. to send tanks of its own. The decision, however reluctant, now paves the way for German-made Leopard 2 tanks to be delivered to Ukraine in 2 or 3 months, provided by several European nations. You thought your shipping time for your jacket was a long time. Yeah. 3 months. While it is unclear whether it will make a decisive difference in the spring offensive that President Zelensky is now planning to take back territory seized by Russia, it is the latest in a series of gradual escalations that has inched the U.S. and its NATO allies closer to direct conflict with Russia. All right, Alan.
So what's new? In other words, this is the kind of confrontation that goes on between this country and the Russians and has for, you know, a jillion years. So I'm not surprised by it, and I think that we all have to sort of stand by and hope that it doesn't escalate.
Ira Fussfeld.
Well, I'm a little surprised about one thing. Not that they're ultimately decided to send the tanks, but as you described it in your lead-in, that Biden supposedly was reluctant to do this. And that surprises me, because he certainly has seemed to be all in right from the beginning, and most Americans would say rightly so. So the fact that he seems not to have been leading on this, I'm not necessarily going to criticize it, but I am surprised by it. The other thing I heard in one of the reports this morning was that Germany was reluctant to step forward and needed the U.S. to get in there so that Germany would not look alone and would not look to be as aggressive as it is, hasn't been known to be militarily through two world wars. And they are apparently very sensitive to that. So, and then you, as you also point out, these tanks are not going to show up on the shipping dock tomorrow. It's sort of like ordering a new car. They've got to build this thing up, and they've apparently it's extremely difficult to operate, so a lot of training is required. So there's more of a symbolic nature to this right now, informing the Russians that the NATO countries still mean business, and this stuff is coming, but there will not be apparently any immediate impact because the tanks won't be there.
The Defense Secretary of the United States, Lloyd Austin, only last week dismissed the idea of sending the Abrams tank, with the aide saying its, quote, long tail of supply and repair vehicles was too complex for the stretched Ukrainian forces to operate. That's to your earlier point, Ira. Just yesterday, Austin said these tanks are further evidence of our enduring, unflagging commitment to Ukraine and our confidence in the skill of Ukrainian forces. Linda Ellerby.
Well, it's interesting. I was listening to earlier to the notion that Biden was reluctant here. I think part of that is that presidents generally like to make decisions based on their own ideas rather than being forced into something. And in this case, I think you can make a case that Biden was pushed in some ways into doing this. My friend Lucian Truscott IV wrote a column yesterday that spoke to an issue that I think it's important that we bring up here of what might be behind a lot of the negotiations here, quite frankly, on Biden's side and what Germany's doing and why Germany, yes, Germany is waiting because it's not good optics for Germany to go in first, but Germany was also waiting for the U.S. for another reason. And that is Germany and France and Canada, all of these nations, all of the NATO nations, not Canada, are waiting because they don't really trust the U.S. at the moment. And the reason they don't is Donald Trump. And this goes back, and Lucian wrote about this yesterday, goes back to when he was president and he was dismissive of the millions of Europeans who died in two world wars. Do you remember how he didn't go to the cemetery because he might get his hair messed up, and how he called them, later it was discovered, he called those people who died in those wars losers, and couldn't seem to figure out. And then even recently, he's still talking about if another NATO nation is attacked, that the U.S. by the Soviet Union, or by Russia in this case, that the U.S. might not come to their aid at all. And these nations are looking at the U.S. and saying, you're going to lead or not? Who are you? You having another Donald Trump come along? What are you going to do? That lit a fire under Joe's feet. And I think, Joe, if there's a reluctance there, it's not a reluctance to help Ukraine. It's a reluctance to be forced into defending that the U.S., being forced into defending that the U.S. is there for NATO, is there for the allies and for the treaties it has signed, that it will honor those treaties.
Dorsey.
You know, this is an interesting dynamic here. I think for President Biden, it's a fine line that he's walking. And there's a distinction between President Biden and his cabinet, and it's clear based on some of the statements that have been made, where members of his cabinet made statements about the complexities of the equipment and Ukrainian soldiers not being able to navigate and operate. And that was a different tune that was sung most recently. And that distinction is the political nature of this conversation, whereas Biden is a politician and members of his cabinet are not. They're speaking from a more practical, logical standpoint, assessing the truth of the matter from their vantage point, and also suggesting that some of the tanks from Germany, you know, they're close in proximity. They would get there quicker. They're less complex. Wouldn't it just make sense for them to make the first move? But President Biden understands the politics of the situation, hence why he's the president. And there's also intel that members of his cabinet won't have, members of the average American won't have. And so we are all outsiders looking in, making decisions based on what we see. But also we need to understand that there's information that we just will not have access to. So it's a fine line. President Biden does not want war with Russia. While I don't think there's a fear factor, it's just what's in the best interest of the United States. So he's balancing what's in the best interest for this country, but also balancing that with this role that we play as a superpower on the global stage. And that was alluded to, and the responsibility that comes with that. And so carefully balancing that, he made the first move, I suspect. There's a notion, I'll end with this so that others could chime in here. There's a notion that culture eats policy for breakfast. And I would say in this case, the culture of politics eats policy. And so this was the most, this was the politically the right thing to do for President Biden, and it was the decision that needed to be made. He understands what's at stake. While not wanting to go to war with Russia is something that's weighing heavily, the other piece of this is what happens if Russia overtakes Ukraine and all of the partners supporting Russia in this endeavor. What does that mean for the United States and other parts of the world? So he understands that very clearly.
Danny Rosari, we have about a minute, but we'll certainly give you more time on the other side if you need it.
I'm worried about the doomsday clock, which has recently ticked that much closer to what, the apocalypse, the end, whatever the measure is, because this is an escalation and there's no way, other way to look at it. I'm also concerned about Russia's allies. What are the Chinese going to do about this? Is the Chinese government going to see that it needs to align itself more with Russia because they're having problems with their gas supply, things like that, that we not may not really understand the implications of, but could possibly push China into a different stance in this conflict? What about Iran? It's already proven that it's a willing partner with Russia. That's a concern for me, and I'm also concerned about the implications for our budget. We all know about the Iraq and conflict and what that did to the deficits, and you know, our children and their children's children will be paying the price for this. And I also understand that there's a lot at stake globally in terms of allowing Russia to just invade another country with impunity. But there's a lot that's at play here, and if things don't go the right way, you know, we're looking at a whole different global landscape here.
Let's go to the letters that we have gotten, and we go to Robert. We are all on a ship together in this storm. Fear of an imaginary doomsday is a wasteful thought. Biden is doing better than any Republican might. We still have peace. If Russia were to take Ukraine, we never would have peace again. We must support Ukraine till the end. That from Robert. We then go to, in this discussion about tanks for Ukrainians, writes Mike, is the tooth-to-tail problem. Tanks require a long logistical chain, parts, ammo, maintenance. Deploying Leopards makes more military sense because Leopards are used by multiple European countries, which all have the necessary logistics in place relatively near Ukraine to assist Ukraine as tanks inevitably break down, need spare parts, etc. Deploying the M1 Abrams, on the other hand, complicates the tooth detail problem. There are fewer were maintenance depots, parts, and less availability. I think Biden announced the deployment of M1 Abrams tanks to get the Germans to move off the dime, which in turn frees up Leopards from various European countries. That from Mike. Mark and Jill, did they both write this letter? No, Mark wrote this letter. Biden's decision to send Abram tanks to Ukraine demonstrates his sound and deliberate decision-making process. His so-called reluctance is a consequence of the advice of the military telling him that the Abrams tanks are hard to maintain, expensive to operate, and not conducive to the battlefield in Ukraine. The German Leopard tanks, perfectly suited for the task at hand, but German Chancellor Scholz refused to act without the U.S. also sending tanks. Consequently, we needed to put skin in the game, which would allow other European countries to send their Leopard tanks. That from Mark.
You know, I want to go back to that moment when the reluctant word was used. Of course we're reluctant. What sane nation in the world doesn't say, as they are committing forces or committing weapons, that they're reluctant to do it? They say it, but whether or not it means anything is another whole story.
Richard writes, could the panel address the less than thinly veiled nuclear threats from Russia now that Ukraine is poised to receive the Leopard, Challenger, and Abrams tanks and longer-range missiles? It is increasingly likely that they will be able to cut off the land bridge to and from Crimea. What is the end game in the event of an increasingly likely Ukrainian victory? Surely Putin cannot afford to capitulate. That from Richard.
So following up on that, if he can't afford to capitulate, what can he afford to do?
I think there has to be some definition of what success looks like. It seems to be a changing, the definition keeps changing. So what is it? Is it now there's talk of there being a desire to recapture some of the places that that Russia has overrun? Is that, you know, is taking that back the definition of success here? Beating back the Russian army till it goes back to its quarters in Russia, allowing for some kind of middle ground here, some type of agreement where part of the land that has been overrun is ceded to the Russians. It just keeps changing all the time, and that's what's so worrisome. What is the definition of success?
Let's see. Heather says, from what I understand, the hesitancy with the U.S. sending tanks to Ukraine was more about logistics than support. U.S. tanks take a lot more fuel or are very expensive to maintain and are difficult to train for. The White House also argued that the tanks used by Germany and other European countries are more readily available. I just wanted to point that out because I don't think support is an issue.
So if I could just respond to that.
Of course.
You know, I think that that is an issue, but it's not the issue. And it also depends on who you ask. As mentioned, I think from the president's standpoint and others, even members of the cabinet, this concern about sending the message that we're trying to go to war with Russia, we're provoking. And so, again, it goes back to this very fine line that the United States and the president is walking. So while that statement was made, I think it was a at surface level, a reason to say, to justify why we should not. But I think that there's some other underlying issues that we also have to be conscious of.
Part of the discussion, I think, that really hasn't been focused on, but it should be. I mean, by virtue of the fact that we're learning so much about Russia's ability to wage war and how this works on the battlefield, you know, there's an advantage to that. I mean, yes, it's costing us a lot of money, but you can bet your bottom dollar that there's a lot of newly acquired information and intel from the battlefield that we're benefiting from. Should, you know, there be another conflict somewhere else involving Russia, or in case this does go to the next level. And also, you know, I'm concerned, too, that war really benefits the military-industrial complex more than anyone else. So, you know, there is a way here that I see that, you know, any war is not good for the world. I mean, there's some serious risks involved here, including the whole nuclear disaster aspect of it, not just in terms of a nuclear bomb, but nuclear power plants. So, you know, I do think that there needs to be some level of caution here, that we need to consider some of the other ramifications involved here. But I just think that, you know, no one on this panel, I believe, thinks that war is a good idea. But understanding the geopolitical things that are at risk here, I think we're locked in this battle, and it's not going to be any sign of relief anytime soon.
Chairman of the Capital District Latinos, Dan Irizarry, on the roundtable panel on Thursday, January 26th. We'll be back with the final segment of the roundtable panel, The Week in Review, after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. On Friday, Alan and Joe were joined by President and CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan, former New York 19 Congressperson and Attorney, John Faso, Siena College Professor of Economics, Aaron Pacetti, and Albany County District Attorney, David Soares.
The five Memphis officers charged with the death of Tyre Nichols, five Memphis officers charged with the murder. They were charged with second-degree murder yesterday with the death of a 29-year-old black man. Simply put, this should not have happened, David Rausch, director of the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation, said of the fatal beating. I am sickened by what I saw. A grand jury returned indictments Thursday against the five. They were fired last week in connection with the beating. Each was being held Thursday afternoon at the Shelby County Jail. All five suspects joined the Memphis police within the last 6 years. Each of them is black, as was Nichols. They are charged with second-degree murder, aggravated assault, acting in concert, two counts of aggravated kidnapping, two counts of official misconduct, and one count of official oppression. Additionally, the Justice Department is conducting a civil rights investigation into Nichols' death. David Soares, I'll begin with you of how we should look at these charges.
Well, before we get into the law, the dynamics of policing, and every other issue that I've heard over the last 24 hours as it relates to this young man's death, I think we, as a nation collectively, we have to just feel for the family of this young man who expected him to be home after a traffic encounter with law enforcement. And once again, the issue that I would note is that if you take into consideration the highest profile police misconduct cases in our country, probably over the last decade, there is a correlation between the level and the lethality of the violence that's perpetrated upon the individual and the offense that they're accused of committing. We've seen everything from cigarette tax interdiction result in death to a general street encounter, which is our most recent high profile that results in death. And here you have a vehicular traffic infraction that resulted in death. And once again, the stage has been set for us to have an emotional and visceral response to the conduct. I anticipate that in our own city, as well as cities all across America, that the conduct of five criminals, and let's just call that what it is, you're not operating under the color of law. You are not representing the interests of the citizens that you've sworn an oath to protect when the initial and reflexive behavior is someone upsets you during your enforcement, your job, and the result is the individual is no longer with us as a result of suffering these beatings. And we as a nation will pay for the conduct of these five officers. You're going to see cities literally broken. And I know that so much has been done in advance of these actions, in advance of this announcement. Both the chief of police in Memphis as well as other leaders have come forward and called for calm. And we know that there is a group of people out there that will not abide by that. And so the conduct of these five police officers not only have stained their department, it has stained law enforcement, all of whom, and I include myself in part of that, have tried every single day to address the past improprieties. We all, whenever we take this oath, whenever we come to this place in our careers, we all we understand that we're entering into it carrying the baggage of all the, you know, injustices of the past. But it's this ongoing work that's required of us to move forward to in fact inform our community that we're here for them and then we're not prosecuting against them. And this just sets everything back.
You talk about the injustices as we as citizens of this country, as we try to figure that out and try to make sense of the what doesn't make any sense. Where, given that history has been white officers involved, mm-hmm. Here you have five officers of color. How should that figure into our into our thinking of this case? Should it be any different?
It shouldn't be any different, because what the conversation, I know that that's what people genuinely look at, right?
Right.
And I understand that, and of course, I got to tell you that I'm actually a bit surprised in this instance, in that we've had these incidents before where we've had officers of color who've you know, committed the same atrocities as white officers, right? It's just that those cases are never elevated in terms of the media profiles. They're never elevated to this point. And in this instance, we have that. And I think it should serve as a reminder that what we're talking about here is not race. What we're talking about here is culture, right? It's this fundamental lack of understanding that when you have worked to earn that badge, that you are in the service of a community, that you are not in service against that community. And this is one of those instances where you clearly see that there is an issue here with the culture where, there was a refusal to see this young man as a young man. And there's no details. Mind you, I normally don't do this. I normally do not provide commentary on anything unless I've seen video footage and unless I have a better understanding of what I'm looking at than just what I'm seeing in reports through the media. But this one is just, it's just so hard. It's just, you know, you wake up in the morning and it's just so hard because it's not just that department that's suffering. It's a member of the Albany Police. It's that department. It's the state. It's anyone. It's anyone who goes to work understanding that we are servants.
Right.
All of us are affected. But that's not to be discussed here, because what I think we should be discussing is the impact on that family and in their community as a result of what's transpired.
No doubt. But we also have to address the culture to improve the culture, right? I mean, that's
we have to do that.
We have to get there.
We have to do that. We have to do that in what I'm always disappointed in is, and I'm disappointed in both leadership. I'm disappointed in both. We choose the wrong moments to engage in conversations. You surely don't choose moments where you're arguing or you're in a firefight with your, you know, significant other to address, you know, very complicated issues, right? And it seems like the only time that we want to engage in these conversations is during one of these horrific events, yeah. Right? And then the people that we oftentimes invite to the table are like this morning, I'm listening to Talking Heads, and in one interview, I heard a so-called expert both condemn policing in Tennessee for what occurred for this tragic death, and by the time he was done speaking, he was condemning the police department for taking quicker action against black officers. So what was the point that you were trying to make, sir? Right. And the reality is, I don't see things getting any better for reasons that I'll explain a little bit later after others have had an opportunity to voice their concerns. But this is yet another setback. It's another setback in the effort, which I think should be a national effort in restoring faith and confidence in policing and law enforcement.
Heather.
First off, I agree with David on everything that he said. I think this is it is a cultural issue. I also recently have been looking at, you know, because I don't know why, but I've had this idea that there might be a better way for making the conduct of police officers who cross the line more attached to them rather than the municipality that they serve. Because right now, in most brutality cases, I may be wrong about this, but as I understand it, if there is a civil settlement, and there's certainly going to be a lawsuit here, I would guess, it's the municipality that pays for it. It's the taxpayers that pay for it. It's not the police department. It's not the police officers. And so there's a disconnect between conduct that crosses the line and personal responsibility. And I think that's something we ought to be looking at. I know that we spend a lot more time on firearms training for police officers than we do on de-escalation. This isn't necessarily that would have been the answer in this circumstance, but the first reaction, which is to respond in kind, is not I don't think one that gets you a solution. And I'm very concerned about the response once the video comes out, because, you know, based on the fact that they held it back and we're getting all these sort of warnings ahead of time, I think it's got to be pretty horrific. And there's definitely a subset of people in our culture who feel like this will justify a violent reaction and violent protests. And certainly there's a subset of people who feel like that's the only solution. And it is so wrong. I mean, if you get a sunburn, the solution isn't to go back out in the sun and lay longer. You don't solve a problem by doubling down on it and doing more of it. Maybe the sunburn isn't the best example, but violence in response is not going to change the culture. We have to have something different.
John.
Well, I don't think there's a single thing that D.A. Soares said that I disagree with at all. I think that this obviously is an extremely tragic situation, and it will be dealt with by law enforcement and the judicial process as it should be. And as Heather said, I certainly hope that calm is maintained, although I have my doubts in Memphis because of this. Communities will become rightly outraged, and hopefully that doesn't extend into violence, which is self-defeating. The thing I think we should also mention, though, is that these incidents are actually statistically exceedingly rare. And we do have a crisis in policing today, and one of the main components of that crisis is the fact that many police officers are getting out of the profession or not people that would be prospective law enforcement officers are choosing not to go into it. And that is also a big, big problem, because the vast majority of law enforcement operate within the law and operate in a way that's dedicated to preserving communities and preserving public safety. These incidents tend to create an impression in the public's mind that these are very prevalent and that this is something that's going on an accelerated basis across the country, when the statistics show that these kind of deadly interactions with police are actually quite rare and uncommon. They do get a lot of media attention, rightly so, because it is outrageous. But we also have to be worried about where we're going in terms of policing, in terms of whether or not communities, and you're seeing this in New York City, there are thousands of officers down in terms of where they should be and where they need to be. Even here in the Capital District, police agencies are reporting difficulty in keeping their officers and attracting new officers. And so we have a lot of work to do.
Well, you know, you were in the state legislature, of course. What is it that you think lawmakers could do to alleviate this?
I'm not quite sure, Alan, because obviously training has been enhanced and, you know, the term culture has been used. I'm not sure what laws can be passed that change that culture. I think we have to be very careful about discussions about qualified immunity because that could be and also another disincentive for people to stay in policing and to go into policing. But I'm not sure, Alan. And I don't want to just kind of react off the top of my head, but I'm not sure what measures can be taken other than to continue to insist that better training and recruitment efforts continue. And so there may be a place for additional laws in that regard. We'd have to look at each individual state in order to determine.
So let me ask you this. Should every police officer have a college education?
No, I don't think college. I think an associate's degree in many instances it would be appropriate, with the additional training about the law and law enforcement and obviously understanding the communities in which they're policing and understanding, as Heather mentioned, how to decelerate confrontation. Mm. And, you know, our police are often asked to do very difficult things. You talk to any police agency and they'll tell you, and I'm sure D.A. Soares would confirm this, one of the most dangerous things that police have to deal with is to deal with domestic disputes. Mm. And to serve a summons or a warrant for something relating to a domestic dispute. And that's really a very tough part of their job. So, but I do think, obviously, there a college degree is not necessarily an automatic example of something that is going to always be required. An associate's degree, I think, certainly.
Aaron?
2 points, one that directly deals with the cultural issue that David brought up. Modern policing is, you know, it's a war on drugs, it's a war on crime, it's a war on everything, and police departments get these massive grants to essentially militarize the police force to engage in these wars. But every war needs an enemy, and the enemy is poor people, specifically poor black people. So, you know, talk about changing the culture. This goes back to Nixon's war on drugs and, you know, what has cascaded from that. I think the bigger issue here, and kind of pains me to say this, but, you know, we are a country that is just coming apart at the seams. It's obviously the, you know, the early stages of what it looks like for an empire to be in decline, but we've had 40 years of rising inequality and diminished opportunity. We're seeing increases in deaths of despair. You add on to that just what's happened in the past, you know, 3 or 4 years with COVID, masks, George Floyd, Stop the Steal and the Big Lie, January 6th, this debt ceiling shenanigan, just mass shooting after mass shooting. Now we have the people who are supposed to be serving and protecting community engaging in these, you know, barbarous acts. I am not optimistic about where this country is headed. I mean, I think we're just going down a really, really dark road, and I don't know what the end looks like, but this is just, you know, tragic, but just one very predictable piece that now fits perfectly into the larger puzzle.
So does the end, are we left with authoritarianism at the end as a result of what you're saying?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'd like to think not, but I'm almost certain that the answer is yes. If you look at every pretty much major world crisis, with the exception of the Great Depression in the U.S., that, you know, when you have economic stagnation, when you have a country that is, you know, experiencing serious, you know, social and economic crisis after crisis, people look for order. People look for some type of authority figure to fill a vacuum and impart some type of structure into their lives. And that, you know, you can, you know, look at Germany in the 1930s and Hungary in the 2010s, and maybe it's the U.S. in the, you know, 2020s or 2030s. I'm not optimistic about what happens coming out of the other side of this either.
Siena College Professor of Economics Aaron Pacetti on the Roundtable Panel on Friday, January 27th. Full episodes of the Roundtable Panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. This has been this week's Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Elizabeth Hill, filling in for Sarah LaDuke. Thank you for listening, and have a great week.